anti-Semitism was concerned, traveling across the country and dealing with all these recruits.
You'll get individual people who are anti-Semitic, but not the army as such.
I see.
Because I have, nobody ever asked me when I was picked for assignments, and I had very, very sensitive assignments.
Were there people you met, Dr. Schlesinger, whom you remember as being particularly able or particularly interesting from your Army experience? People who truly influenced you?
Yeah, I'd say practically our entire group was a very cohesive group with a high degree of Supreme Corps. General, I mentioned General Goodman, who's one of the Hayden M.A. and Harley Brown, another man named Jones. I can't remember the other fellow, but he was a commandant to the Officer Canada School. He picked me up and he said, "Well, I want you on my staff." There's General Evans who cut all kinds of corners to get me on Eisenhower's staff, and I couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. Most of the people I dealt with, a small group, later went on to top positions in the Department of Defense.
Were these professional Army people, most of them, people who had given their
West
careers, West Point people?
Yeah. Either were West Pointers, or they were ROTC graduates from college. Mm-hmm. But I'd say that 78% of these were West Pointers.
Was General Goodman a West Pointer?
I'm not sure if he was or wasn't. He was originally in artillery. He may have been. I don't remember for sure about him.
I'm just curious about Jews at West Point.
I'm not sure
at that
he was or
point.
Wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay. I know when he first came in, people feared they were going to pull the wool over his eyes because what does an artillery man know about all this stuff? He turned out to be a very good guy. Hmm. He also had a very lovely daughter, and I used to go out socially with the family, but never with a daughter.
Hmm.
Because I didn't want to mix and get in wrong with him over his daughter.
Yeah. During this time that you were in the Army and you were in various parts of the United States, were there any locations that were particularly interesting to you? Any
I like the South, per se, Georgia.
Did you have some experiences with the Jewish communities in the South?
Well, Atlanta, I found the best one. I was in Atlanta one time. I lived off post, and I was waiting for a bus. Somebody drives by, picks me up. And I remember the name Zacharias because it related to people that helped start my fraternity. So he said, "What are you doing Saturday night?" And I said, "Nothing." He said, "You come on over to that city club," which was equivalent to Concordia.
Hmm.
And they opened up all their doors to any you want to. So while I was in Atlanta, anytime I wanted to go there, they took care of me.
What was the background of the Atlanta Jewish community?
I don't know.
You don't have any sense of...
They were pretty wealthy.
They were not mostly Eastern European Jews,
so.
I would imagine. No.
They could have been maybe one or two generations past. But they're all pretty wealthy commercial industrial people, some professional.
And apparently very welcoming and warm to service people.
Well, I found one of the best of them all. Chicago was pretty good. Pittsburgh did not find particularly warm.
Hmm.
I mean, I wasn't home very much. In 4.5 years, I had about 9 days of leave. But when I came to Pittsburgh, I could see how they treated people.
Mm.
It was done as an obligation rather than a desire.
This is the Jewish community that we're talking about, or the community
Jewish,
generally?
Jewish, non-Jewish. Huh. It's the same thing. It has nothing to do with it. But I've had a running battle with the Jewish people in Pittsburgh when it comes to Passover and holidays. They do not invite particularly people to come to their homes for home hospitality. Put a sign up. If you want to have a kosher meal or something like that for Passover, call the neighbors or something like that, or call the hill. That I said is wrong, what they should do. We used to do it. We lived in the house, call the university and say, "Look, we have space for 3 people for a Seder."
Do you think you have students particularly, or and strangers in the city?
Well, I did it with students,
because
I can see them being around here. But the synagogues in Pittsburgh don't do that. The people don't do it. I've had running battle with Tree of Life. I don't do it. Minnesota.
Hmm.
One year when I was president, they did. And, but I was in San Francisco for Passover one time. Well, so there was a general public seder. I went there the first night. It was like any other public seder. The second night I went to a little tiny synagogue in Oakland, California. Because it was like a sort of a very, very hardened Orthodox Jew. There were only about 12, 15 people from the minyan. So he invited me to his home. And they were a very poor family, I could tell. But a much nicer service you probably won't find. Mm. And that's the difference between home hospitality and calling up and saying, send somebody over.
Yes. Yes. That's a good point.
They don't, the Jews in Pittsburgh don't do that.
Let's talk now about your family. You married Natalie when?
December 1950.
December 1950, and you've lived in Pittsburgh then throughout your marriage.
That's right.
Okay, and can you tell us about your family, about children?
Well, we had a son who died. Oh. He was born with brain defect. He had died when he was about 12, 13. I have an older daughter who's a deputy attorney general. She lives in Harrisburg. She's married. Her husband's a lawyer there. I have a younger daughter who's going to get married in September.
Are there grandchildren of your married daughter? I see. And she's in Harrisburg, you said.
That's right. Well, outside of that.
Yeah, will your younger daughter live in Pittsburgh after she's married? Oh, that would be very nice for you. Okay, so that gives us some sense then of your person.
Natalie is. She had an employment office when we got married. So she sold that out, which she should not have, because I had a lot of connections. She would have become a top employment officer.
Yes.
But instead, she went in to do volunteer work. She did presidents or something to do with volunteer agencies for 35 years.
That's a very estimable record.
And has spent a lot of her own money not getting anything.
What are her favorite areas of volunteerism? Does she have some particular things that she's especially fond of and devoted to?
She was president of the Women's Association here. She liked. She was president of Sisterhood of the Tree of Life. Her biggest objection is, she was chairman of the donor, is you work real hard and people don't come to the affairs.
It's one of the tough things about being a hardworking volunteer. You always get the support.
Or you also get somebody who doesn't support or criticizes.
Yes, yes. I'm afraid that's...
Right now, she's chairman of a new committee. I'm co-chair, but she's really running it. Senior citizens at the program for the senior citizens at the synagogue.
Ah, good for her.
What synagogue?
Tree of Life.
Tree of Life. Oh.
And she doesn't know exactly what they want. She did, some years ago, she did work at the Anathan House before they moved into the house, and they're up on the 4th Street upstairs there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a woman, her name was something like Sondheimer, but that wasn't it. I think her daughter's married Jack Brewer. And she ran.
I see.
Natalie did a lot of work up there with the seniors before they went into Anthem House. And she's trying to remember the things and would draw them to someplace for activities.
Oh, yes, that's such an important area.
And this becomes more now because the hike's being closed down.
Yes, yes. Is her hope then that synagogues like Tree of Life might be able to fill in the gap a bit?
She doesn't know what the others want to do, but she'd like to do something that will fill in some kind of a gap or bring people to there some afternoons.
Okay.
Would you clarify the difference between, let's say, Tree of Life, Road of Shalom, and Beth Shalom? How do they...
Yeah, Beth Shalom, first of all, you've got to clarify the difference between Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Right.
All right. Road of Shalom is Reformed with a little modification under Rabbi Jacobs. He lets you have a yarmulke, you have to have bar mitzvah, bar mitzvah. Pure Reform doesn't have that. Reform has one day of holidays, Rosh Hashanah and all the other holidays. One. we formed features, usually a Friday night and Sunday service, not a Saturday. Now, Rose Shulman has all those things. Rose Shulman has a Saturday service, which is Rabbi Jacob's introduction. Rose Shulman has a yarmulke, so if you want to wear it, then I've got to tell you not to. They have Bar Mitzvahs.
Plus an organ, right?
Well, the organ.
Organ music.
Yeah, that. That's a different proposition. Now, the conservative, the Orthodox is the very Orthodox, which divides men and women. They don't sit together.
But that would not be Beth Shalom.
No, that's not Beth Shalom, not Orthodox. Orthodox, women have no rights in the Orthodox. They can't sit on the bimah, they can't call the Torah, they can't have an aliyah, they can't, I don't even think they can get an office for much here. Now, then you get the conservative. We have conservative right and conservative left. Beth Shalom is conservative right, which observes everything that the Orthodox does, except they don't separate the men and the women. And now, particularly under the new rabbi, they will permit, probably permit, bar and bat mitzvahs on Saturday for girls. They permit women officers, but do not permit women to have aliyahs.
Women what?
To have an aliyah, to call the Torah.
Oh, to have an aliyah.
So, Tree of Life is conservative left, where women have equal rights. For example, we have a minyan every morning and every night. You need to have 10 people, and most frequently, two or three of them are women. And they get called the Torah conflict. I was there, not this past Saturday, a week ago Saturday. And three of the seven aliyahs are women. Beth Shalom won't permit that. The service is a shorter service because they don't have a Muslim service. So your service is divided into Sabbath and Muslim. We get the introductory and the concluding one. They don't have a Muslim service because it's cut out because that deals with sacrifices. And the conservative left does not believe in sacrifices. They cut that out completely. All holidays are one days except Rosh Hashanah.
How are they to the strangers in town? Or are they welcome?
They're very welcome to come to the synagogue. Anybody wants to come in, comes in. As a matter of fact, their minyan that they have every day in a week, we probably pick up two or three members a year. Somebody has a death. They come to say Kaddish.
Mm-hmm.
And they welcome the person so nicely and have coffee, cake, or something like that every morning that they decide to join.
But what happens, the reason I'm asking you this, Rosh Hashanah does not allow anyone to come to their high holiday services unless you have a paid ticket. So that eliminates inviting any strangers,
yeah, well,
visitors.
If you want to have somebody come to the high holidays, you can, students will put seats up in the back. If you can afford it, they'll charge you for a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't afford it, we have consecutive services. You can't come, say for example, Kol Nidre, there's an early one and a late one. You'll have to come to the late service. The first day of Rosh Hashanah, there's an early one and a late service. You'll have to come to the late service. The first one is completely taken up. So you can get into the service, or if somebody calls up and says, look, here's a poor family in town, we need a pair of tickets. Dave Dingle will say, oh, come on, I'll get you some seats. I don't think I've ever turned anybody out. Well, the kind that they won't give you to, which is, let's suppose that here's a member. The member withdraws. And then they want to get a ticket. They want to come in for the holiday. So they just come there 3 days a year and they want to come there.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a child who's 30 years old and you'd like to get a seat for the child. That's a different story. If there's a poor family or stranger, they get it. Matter of fact, our Russians never even look at the tickets.
Right.
That's why they have consecutive services. Mm-hmm. We finish up one and they go another.
Okay. I'd like to go on now with your professional life, your time at the university, your work as an economic consultant, those kinds of things. So perhaps we can talk about that. Let's talk about your career here at the university. You must have seen many changes during the time.
I've seen seven chancellors. And essentially, you keep going around the circle.
Yes.
Because at one time, there was a very sharp split between humanities, natural sciences, and social sciences. Mm-hmm. A consulting firm came along and said this ought to be consolidated. Now there's some sentiment splitting it up. Mm-hmm. The same consulting firm that recommended Pitt to consolidate was doing a good job at Case Western, who was consolidated, and they recommended the Case Western split to have what Pitt used to have. I was an associate dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences for a while. I was under, I think it was Litchfield's last days, and then under Crawford, Nutting, Kurtzman, and Boswell.
You mentioning the various chancellors reminds me that you might want to comment on them, on their leadership, on some of the things you remember.
Well, Litchfield, I had an unusual opportunity. I got to know him personally through a completely outside connection. Mm-hmm. Very different person individually than what the reputation around here was.
He was here when? Was that the 50s?
Probably from about 57, 8 to about 65, 6, somewhere around there.
What were your impressions of his work as a chancellor?
He was great visionary. If the city of Pittsburgh had listened to him, Pittsburgh would be now one of the developers in research and development that went to the Silicon Valley, that went to Houston, went to Cape Canaveral. He had the idea of rebuilding a whole research area down in Panther Hollow.
Yes, I remember that.
Right.
Yes.
Nothing happened.
He couldn't get the ground assembled. Hmm. And the city said, well, it's not going to work anyways, because U.S. Steel and Bethlehem aren't going to go to combine research. This isn't going to happen, that's not going to happen. Because companies were too interested in their own personal welfare at that time to go into a joint program. And I got to know him reasonably well a couple different ways. First of all, my wife was president of the Women's Association. She knew his wife. And he was a very different individual socially, because we would ride over to his house for a dance one night. He stood on Beach Boulevard before he built his big house. And it was a little cold. We were going to leave about 11:30 because it was outdoors. He stopped my wife and said, you haven't danced with me yet. She said, well, you didn't ask me. So they stayed till 2 o'clock in the morning because he was socializing, not as a chancellor. Mm-hmm. Another time he had a little boy who was about the same age as my older daughter, went to a Christmas party here. The boy was probably 5-6 years old. My daughter's about the same age. One of the faculty stops him and said, Dr. Litchfield, I've been trying to see you for couple of weeks to talk to you about something. He says, fine. He said to me, you take care of my little boy for a while. And then he bawled out this family member tremendously. He says, this is my son's party here for Georgia. I'm not here to talk business with you. When he played hard. When he worked hard. Nothing for him to call you at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, we're going to have a meeting in half an hour. Mm. Another time I was given a pin for 20 years service at the university. And he said, would you like to go to dinner tonight? And to call Natalie. And I figured he's got to go someplace here to dinner. I said, this sounds pretty good. I said, what time? He said, well, it'll take us about an hour to get to the airport. And then we'll fly up. Maybe we can make a show in New York. And I knew his pilot very well, because he was friendly people in my reserve unit. And I didn't like that idea, because he'd call the pilot and say, I'm going to go to New York for dinner. I'll fly back 2 o'clock in the morning, a little private plane. And sometimes he would tell the pilot, well, look, I'm not going to fly tonight. Also, the pilot might have a drink. And he calls him, the pilot is not 200% sober. So I concocted an excuse, but that's how he worked it. Mm-hmm. Go along, suddenly split to someplace else. Well, with Boswar, I got to know him completely differently, because I was very friendly with the colonel in the Army, he calls me one Friday afternoon and says, "You want to know who your next president is?" Next chancellor. I said, "How do you know?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "Tell me the whole life story in 10 minutes. Because that's West Point, we know what's going on."
Hmm.
So I had a lot of military connections that cut across Paul's work.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and his wife were very friendly because she put on the first concert here in Pittsburgh. She's performed for the sisterhood a couple of times.
Yes.
So I got to know him personally. And he's the kind he'll see in the hall and say, they call me by my first name or something like that. We were invited to his daughter's wedding. So, a different kind of personal relationship with Litchfield. And with Litchfield, you never knew when the business was stopping and the personal started.
Hmm.
With him, you do. Uh-huh.
What what was his fate?
Litchfield.
Litchfield?
Yeah, well, he was up in his, he had a farm up in Cook's Forest. And one night, I think it was a Friday night, he and his wife, his little boy, and his mother-in-law, going to fly to Kansas, where his mother-in-law lived. Mother, I'm not sure which one. They crashed in Lake Erie and they're all killed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was a terrible tragedy. What about changes at the University of Pittsburgh as you've seen them over your long tenure as a university person?
They, as I said, they keep coming and going. A lot of it's the same thing. When I was at the New York Board of Embarkation, we got a new general. He didn't like Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Because this particular general had fouled up the Pacific. And if it weren't for him, the Pacific, there would have been less casualties in some of the Pacific activities. Mm-hmm. So the Army didn't want a corporation, they transferred it to New York. And he became my commanding general for a while. General Goodman, General Groninger, removed from New York to California, the Pacific, to get that straight. So he called me and he says, "Give me the orders by means of which this installation operates. And you give him a whole list of things." He says, "I don't like them, I'm going to change them." And by Monday, there were a whole series of new changes. So when somebody comes in, if anything was functioning before, they don't tend to accept it because then he said, "Well, what do we need you for?"
Mm-hmm.
So he had to put everything new. So he put stuff in new, and it lasted 1 week. And I told you, you're going to have trouble. It lasted 1 week, and you almost had a revolt. Well, for example, I was living in Greenwich Village. He said, "You can't live there anymore, you have to live at Fort Hamilton." It didn't make a difference to him as long as I got to where I was supposed to be on time.
Right, right.
And they had my number. So I said, "Well, it'll take me 2 weeks." He said, "Okay, within 2 weeks, you'll be in Fort Hamilton." And in 5 weeks, I knew I was going to be in San Francisco for my vacation. Well, within about 7 days, he changed the orders so he could stay at the Greenwich Village. So I mean, I hadn't given up my place yet. But he did things like that. And this reminds me of a new personnel come here. They change everything. Like when the new provost was here, he changed everything. And then you have to backtrack.
What about students? Changes in them as you've seen over the years?
The best students were the GIs right after World War II.
How do you account for that?
Because they were older, they were interested, they came here for a reason. It wasn't as a 17, 18 year old being sent by his parents because he got to go to school. It was somebody who came for a reason and had to work hard, didn't have much money. During the 60s, I didn't have any trouble with the students, but I didn't like the way half of them dressed and acted. And they were very, very much interested in non-academic activities.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a system called credit no entry. You pass a course, you don't pass a course, you have no record. And I'd have a lot of those. I have a typical class in mind, I have 200-300 people in the class. And maybe half of them credit no entry. The ones now, I might get one. Before I had a class last term with 440 students, one was a credit no entry.
Hmm.
And he was sorry he did it.
You have a class of over 400?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Are you finding current students then more conservative,
more conscious? More grade conscious, mm-hmm. But no brighter.
Yes.
I mean, you asked the one 20 years ago, the price of something were $3 and now it's $4.50, which is a percentage increase, they couldn't do it and they can't do it now either. Now at least they put it down on a calculator, you get an answer, but they don't know why they're doing it, which is worse.
Are you pessimistic about the future of education in America?
No. I don't think you have to make everybody into a scientist. I think they should know about human relations.
I find it interesting about these classes because I teach a community college with 18 or 12 in a class. How is it to handle over 400 students?
And once you get over 30 or 40, it doesn't make any difference.
Then you don't get to know them individually? Is that what?
I don't think that makes any difference.
Doesn't?
I get to know a whole bunch of them in my office. What do you teach here?
Business. I have 40 years of background in retail business, but I can teach any part of business, how to run a successful business. And there are hundreds of people that want to learn how to go into business.
That's the new gimmick, entrepreneurship.
Right. Yes.
What business were you in?
Wearing apparel. I had a chain of retail stores for 40 years.
Where?
Places like Wilkinsburg, McKeesport, Swissville.
What was the name of McKeesport?
Ace, A-C-E. We dealt with the working man. We were right near that railroad track.
Right near Star Market. Star Restaurant.
Right near Star. Is that, did you live in McKeesport?
No, but it's my
wife is from
McKeesport. That's right, yes, that's right. Yes. And you know it.
Okay, let's, there are a lot of things I'd like to talk about related to what you think of Pittsburgh and the changes economically in the time.
I think that they're behind the eight ball.
Explain what you mean, Dr. Sessions.
Because they didn't want to recognize a long time ago what was in the handwriting of the wall. When Lawrence was mayor, when Barr was mayor, they used to have an economic committee. I was on that committee. And at that time, you couldn't get labor and management to cooperate. In addition to that, they figured, well, the steel mills are here, they're going to be here all the time. You don't have to do anything about trying to bring in any other kind of industries. Same as part of the Litchfield problem you ran into. Couldn't get the cooperation to get other kinds of industries to come in here.
Where do you see the fault? In local politicians and the corporations?
Combination of corporations, politicians. Let me give you the story. I'm a steel industry economist.
I know you are.
And let me give you the story in the steel industry. Back in the 1950s, the industry was doing pretty well. But they're just the beginning of foreign competitions. Steel workers went to the companies and said, look, you're making money, modernize. Put in a basic oxygen furnace. The industry said you can't do it because we need 300 ton heats. The steel is no good. You can't use it for high rises. You can't use it for bridges. So they wouldn't do it. So then the union said, well, if you're not going to modernize, then we want more wages. They compromised on what's called the COLA, Cost of Living Adjustment Index. At that time, they should have modernized. But they wouldn't modernize because they said we're doing very well without modernizing. Very, very short vision.
Yes.
The biggest competitor of the steel industry then was not foreign steel, but it was aluminum.
Mm-hmm. You're a Pittsburgher. Family here, contacts here, your life here. What do you see for this city?
I think it's a declining population, number one. You take, for example, our MBA graduates. Most of them want to work around here, but they're going to have to move, they can't find jobs. So those bright people are going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
You build they all talk about high tech. The trouble with high tech is that high tech doesn't employ very many people. And second place, the people they do employ aren't the ones in Pittsburgh. If you were an unemployed scar from the steel mill, you used to make $40,000 a year, you can't find a job.
Huh.
High tech won't even hire you.
See, any hope for a revival in the steel industry here?
No. Revival of the steel industry, but not here.
Not in Pittsburgh.
Because the markets aren't around here. Markets are more around Chicago and Southwest.
Mm. what you're saying sounds as though you think Pittsburgh will not again be the kind of vibrant city that it once was.
Not that type. No, it's not where a youngster is 16 years old in high school and says, okay, I'll go to steel and make $9 an hour. My father's making 14, my grandfather's making 18. Because his father, with 22 years seniority, just lost his job. So there are very, very few opportunities. There can't be too many McDonald's to go to, except because he doesn't want to work at McDonald's for $4 an hour.
But how do you feel about the resurgence in downtown, all these new buildings going up?
They're office buildings.
Right.
That doesn't create any employment.
Well, who's going to fill them?
The same people that are in the other office buildings. Take, for example, Union Trust has a big vacancy now. Because recently Sean McClay moved up to the old light building. National Steel Building. McCann Ingersoll, they moved from the steel building down there. So you keep moving around, but you're not getting very little net new stuff coming in. Allegheny Ludlum is cutting back. Gulf went out. And if they do come in, supposing for argument's sake, AT&T puts headquarters in Pittsburgh. So what's that going to do? Employ a couple hundred secretaries. That's all. Mm-hmm. It's not going to employ any steel mill workers. It's not going to employ any young people high school.
What do you see as some kind of positive direction for the city? Is there anything good
to look for?